The following talk was given by Jed Larson at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 25, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Glad to be able to be here with you today. I think a lot of you know what the Boundary Waters is, but I thought I'd just give a quick description in case some people aren't familiar with that. The Boundary Waters is an area in what's called the Arrowhead of Minnesota. So if you look at a map of Minnesota, you'll see kind of a sharp angle in the upper east part of the state. And a lot of that is the Superior National Forest. And within there, pretty much the northern side of that, all the way up to the Canadian border, is a wilderness designated area called the Boundary Waters. Cars or vehicles or roads or anything. So it's just, when you go up there, you're hearing the sounds of nature, and that's pretty much it. You may hear a jet flying over very occasionally, just off in the distance. But other than that, it's a pristine wilderness area with a network of different lakes. Pretty much, I don't know what the density of lakes are, but it's just an incredible amount of water. Pine forests and Canadian Shield rock outcropping. And my wife and I were up there about a week ago, a little over a week ago, for a five-day trip. And we were paddling back at the end of our trip. And it was just another very quiet day, just a gentle headwind as we're coming back into Brule Lake, a couple lakes actually before that. And pretty striking thing happened, I think partially because it is so quiet up there, particularly for this trip, just extremely quiet, very little wind. We're paddling along the edge of the lake, and then this eruption of sound happened up maybe 100, 200 feet in front of us from the shoreline, this great crashing sound, which completely drew our attention. I was wondering if it was some sort of landslide or what it was. The crown of a tree was coming through the other surrounding trees and crashed into the lake. And it didn't take too long to figure out that it was a beaver at work. A beaver had just felled a tree, pretty big sized birch tree. So this sound was just exploding through the air and lands, and then it's just peace again. And I thought I'd bring up this story in relation to a couple readings that I'll bring into the talk here as well. Because this image of the beaver, for me, I think is kind of a helpful way of getting a little bit of a taste of a perspective that's a little bit different than what we're used to. And that is seeing an animal out in nature that is essentially completely not separated from its environment. I mean, to think of even a beaver as being in the environment is, it doesn't even make sense. The beaver is the environment. So you have an animal who is actually creating the topography, the way the lakes are, the very lake that we are in was completely dependent. The water level was basically dependent on this beaver. As we all know, they make different structures, including dams, and create whole many ecosystems just through their own activity. And this kind of image, I think, as I will go into these two pieces, will contrast a little bit of how we as human beings approach the world and how we can tend to think of things as being outside or like an environment separate from ourselves, and how we can actually sort of break through to a different type of understanding, something more nuanced, essentially clarifying what in Buddhism is called wholeness. One of the sections I'll be referring to is from Steve Hagen's book, Buddhism Plain and Simple. He brings in the teaching of intention, and that will play into this. This intentional aspect, I was reading a New York Times article, and in reading this article, it was about the relationship between farmers and beavers, and you could see pretty clearly how intention is a part of, or has been a part of, how farmers and industry and different actors have often related to the natural world, including beavers. So in this story, it talked about some of the techniques where farmers would use dynamite to blow up beaver dams, because essentially when you have flooding or like a water area being created, that can reduce tillable land or ranchable land. But in the article, it talked about other farmers who were starting to understand a more symbiotic relationship with the beaver. So they're doing things a bit differently than perhaps was more common in the past. So these farmers and researchers would, through paying closer to attention to what the beaver is and what it, the role it plays in the environment, could see that a lot of the flooding, kind of the fluctuations basically in water movement, are mediated by the beaver. The beaver subdues erosion, recharges groundwater, increases biodiversity, creates barriers for wildfire problems when you have more rivers and wider rivers and so forth. And it was a story, I think, again, of kind of a picture into our own mind a little bit, how we'll often want to fix things or change things in different ways. It's just common for, if we're faced with some sort of predicament or something that seems like we can change, there's an impulse to try to so-called fix it. But in a lot of cases, we can see that this doesn't really work. And in the case of the beaver, like not working is, I was thinking of an example of how, maybe we'd have the notion that we could go in and trap a lot of beavers because we want the felt from the pelt to make hats. And this is, I think, just an example of how things don't end up working in the end, because, historically we see that what happened is the beavers were trapped out. So the intention to go in and try to do something and think that it won't have other ramifications, again, kind of gets back to this understanding that often our intentions or what we're thinking about doesn't actually work in the end. It may be have a narrow type of effect, but we're not seeing the other aspects of it. We're not seeing a complete picture. The two books I'll be referring to again, I don't need the books. I bring them along to show people which books I'm using. And I just realized that if I show this book, it's not too helpful. So, but you can see the side is Buddhism Plain and Simple. And the other one is You Have to Say Something by Dainin Katagiri. That's Steve Hagen's teacher, Stephen Norm's teacher. And the chapter I'll be referring to here is The Source of Existence from You Have to Say Something by Dainin Katagiri. Katagiri says, truth, the source of existence, and another word for that we could use is wholeness, source of existence, he says is unattainable, unknowable. But if I say unknowable or unattainable, you might then believe you cannot attain it, touch or know truth. If you think the source of existence is over there and you are here, this is a dualistic understanding. The source of existence is not a thing, although you are never apart from it. If you say, I am one with the source of existence, you will feel a gap. In reality, however, there is no gap. The source of existence needs no explanation, but it doesn't matter whether you explain it or not. It supports your life and the life of all sentient beings. The source of existence is the source of existence. Category has a couple examples here about thinking of wholeness or the source of existence as something over there. And the other example is that we may think, I am one with the source of existence. And reading those two things seem very different, but it occurred to me that they're basically the same thing. And that is that we're creating a gap of some sort, whether we think it's out there or we think that we are part of it. It's this notion of separation, basically. It's a way of operating that will have the ideas of attaining and gaining things that are apart from us, which is related to what he was saying, the source of existence is unattainable, unknowable. Katagiri then goes on and says, because you exist, you see the world from your point of view. Because many things connect with your individual life, you cannot ignore your individuality. This is why Buddhism teaches Dharma, truth, with explanations that are connected with your individual life. That is why Buddhists have developed extensive systems of philosophy and psychology. But Dharma remains unknowable and unattainable. No concept can hold it. Because of this, it is free. So here Katagiri is talking about our individual life and hearing about these teachings and trying to make sense of what they are. You know, we'll kind of come at it from our personal point of view. But again, in respect to this phrase of unattainable and unknowable, we see a teaching that I think is exhibiting that actually what is happening is fully here already. So the idea of attaining something or gaining some sort of knowledge or some kind of command of is not what is happening. It's kind of maybe like thinking of the beaver as thinking that the beaver can attain nature or something like that, which is a little maybe more stark, that just doesn't make sense at all. I mean, the beaver already is of nature itself. So that's what I think Katagiri is talking about here in terms of unknowable and unattainable. Whatever we may think about it, it's not going to capture what this truth is already. Reality is reality. Or the source of existence is the source of existence, Katagiri says. K Katagiri starts the this chapter out actually with a short koan. I'll read that. It indicates kind of where this phrase comes from. The monk Tenno asked his teacher, Sakito Kisen, what is the meaning of the Buddha's teaching? Sakito said, it is unattainable and unknowable. Will you say more? Tenno asked. The teacher said, the great sky doesn't bother the function of the white cloud. So this is where the phrase unattainable and unknowable is coming from in this chapter. The great sky doesn't bother the function of the white cloud. I think you could see or draw a few things out of that particular phrase. And one of them is essentially what Katagiri says here, the source of existence is the source of existence. So, and I should mention the imagery of the great sky would be representative of truth or realization. And then the clouds floating by are representative of thinking, concepts, just our general idea of what our life is. So those are the two aspects. So the great sky doesn't bother the function of the white cloud is a way of saying that regardless of what we may think, the source of existence is the source of existence. The other side of it, I think, is that when we sit, the clouds are forming and dissipating. They come and go on their own. And they may seem undesirable or even something that we don't want, but actually they have no bearing on what the great sky is. So I think it's a teaching of communicating that in this sitting, we can just experience, or there can just be this experience of coming and going of the clouds and freely letting them flow, not trying to intervene at all. In Buddhism, Plain and Simple, Steve talks, as I was saying about intention a little bit before that, I wanted to read a little bit where he talks about interdependence. Steve says, and this is in the chapter, from the chapter Interdependence. He says, when Buddhas look at the world, they don't see solidity. They don't see selves. They only see flux. This is not to say that the awakened no longer see forms like the rest of us. They do, but they see form, or rather formness, as illusory. They see that all things arise together. They see that the apparent existence of anything is dependent on all that it is not. Excuse me. And they see this dependence as nothing other than change and motion themselves. So the beginning of that, Steve talks about solidity and self. I think this ties into Katagiri's talking about the gap. And if we think that something is outside of us, or we are one with something, there's this notion of solidity or selfhood. But the story of seeing all things arise together, kind of like the story of the beaver, you can see in this image of the beaver, what the beaver does is what the environment is, and vice versa. These things are arising together. And I also wanted to mention that in using some of these examples, it's there's a limit to kind of creating some kind of imagery about understanding what interconnection, interdependence is. So hold the example of the beaver lightly. It's just a way of, I think, moving out of how we normally see things, as I was saying before, just to get a little different perspective of something that's different than our kind of very strong sense of cause and effect. So this image of the beaver being the lake itself, basically, it's dictating it and it's living in the lake. It's the dependence is going both ways clearly. In this example of how Steve talks about solidity, you start the section off here. Also, I think is a way to see or get a sense of what seamlessness is. And that itself ties in also to this earlier phrase of unknowable and unattainable, to the degree that we think something is attainable or knowable, that in itself is to presume a separation. So attainable, knowable, you know, how would those be possible if they were not something out there to get, right? So solidity, the gap, seeing ourselves, object, subject, so forth. This orientation is different than seamlessness itself. Seamlessness is the knowing of reality is only possible because of seamlessness. If it was something outside, then again, we're back in the situation of dichotomy. So again, it's the only way knowing is possible is that it is not separate from the very start. That's what knowing our truth is. So it's kind of a bringing together of knowing, experience, and truth itself. This is seamlessness. There's no inside, no outside, which is a foreign thing. I mean, to think of reality and knowing as being the same thing is kind of mind-boggling. You know, you would think I need to know about reality, you know, I need to know something else. But I think seamlessness actually gets us much closer to understanding experience and reality are not separate things ultimately. And as Katigiri says, cannot form, you can't come to an understanding conceptually of what this is. So kind of getting into territory that sounds a little vague or something, but I think it can be helpful to kind of dip into that a little bit, that there is actually nothing to attain. Everything is here already. Steve goes on and talks a little bit about intention. He talks about the natural world. He says, the world as a whole has no intention, no inclination, no leaning of mind as we do. The whole generates these apparent forms and patterns in a way that our willed action cannot. The falling of a leaf from a tree, the flowing of a stream, the sound and movement of wind, all these are natural, effortless, wondrous, deeply alive. And all are the activities that are unwilled. He says that the whole neither leans towards nor away. This doesn't mean that we're incapable of acting in a natural way. We all are. In fact, this is precisely how a Buddha acts, out of the whole. So this introduction of intention is why I brought up the story of the technique of, say, destroying a beaver dam in order to obtain some sort of result. You can see pretty clearly that there's intentional action going on there. So this is just a way of understanding what's going on, what, again, in this human situation that we're in, to understand what inclination is and just to see it clearly. Steve talks about, let's see here. He says, our problem has to do with intention. Because we ignore the whole, we're taken by the parts. So because we ignore the whole, we're taken by the parts. We're seduced by the objects of our consciousness, our concepts. And with longing and loathing, greed and anger, our minds start to lean towards and away. And this is dukkha, or an out-of-kilter way of life. So here, you see Steve introducing this teaching of objects. I mean, it's kind of a continuation. Basically, that's what's happening with intention. Subject and object are there, and then there's some sort of leaning that happens either towards or away. So we kind of trace this intention back to subject and object, inside and outside. And that is so compelling to us, you know, this kind of fragmented world where we think about different things and we have opinions about different things. And a story from a book that I'm reading came to mind in respect to this. what's the name of it? The Education of Little Tree, which is a story of a young Native American boy who's being raised by his grandparents in Depression era. And this story, again, I think, is getting to, again, this notion or this kind of strong inclination of framing the world up in terms of like good and bad, this and that, the different dichotomies that we come up with. And the grandfather in this story is teaching the young boy, Little Tree, about the relationship between the quail and the fox. And the grandfather is explaining, and I mean, if we just normally think about that, those are seem like pretty natural. You know, there's predator and prey there. So it seems very like a pretty strong dichotomy, especially if you're the quail, right? Like if you see a fox coming, it really seems like one is one and the other is the other. There's kind of protagonist and so forth there. But the grandfather's talking about how the quail is eaten by the fox. But in that process, the fox always devours the most weak quail of the group. So in that process, there's a thinning out of the weak quail, which actually helps the quail as a group survive. It doesn't have to support the entire group, which may be impossible in some ways. It focuses the energy of the quail. And the grandfather goes on and says that the fox also, along with eating the quail, it eats small mammals and rodents that eat quail eggs. So the fox at the same time is helping the quail in this activity of propagating its own kind. So there's many different things going on there. So what seems like very black and white, this is this, this is that, one is good, one is bad, however we want to sort of frame that up. The closer we look at these things, you can't land with complete certitude on any type of explanation of what's going on. There's subtleties that bubble out of anything that we look at. As Katagiri says earlier on, concepts can never explain this, can't explain the source of existence. So the story of the quail and the fox, we think we can explain who's who there, but it's, you know, you just look further and further, there's this network of interdependence that breaks down any type of strident assertion that we may have to begin with. Steve Hagen then says, there's a way out of this dilemma. Is again, continuing on with the teaching about intention. There's a way out of this dilemma. It is simply to watch our own mind and to know when it's leaning. So that's pretty simple kind of instruction there, or task to take up. This ties in to the other piece for me, and that the great sky is not obstructing the clouds freely floating, that it's not a matter of trying to pick out the clouds and get them out of there. This is just about noticing intention, just letting clouds pass through. Whether we think they're pleasant or unpleasant, just letting them pass through as they are. Let that drifting happen, occur naturally. There's actually a commentary by the great teacher Dogen Zenji on this koan. And the original koan, again, is the great sky doesn't bother the function of the white cloud. Dogen gives us an even more expansive sense of non-obstruction. This understanding that the world is not inside, outside, this, other. It's actually non-obstruction. That's the nature of reality. And Dogen says, the great sky does not obstruct the drifting of the white clouds. White clouds are drifting without obstruction. Furthermore, the drifting of white clouds does not impede the great sky. So with this expansive and all-encompassing way of looking at things, Dogen is including every option possible and saying to us that obstruction is actually not what is happening. Steve Hagen, as we get closer to the end of the chapter, says, continuing on with his instruction about just noticing leaning, he says, when you notice that your mind is caught up in longing and loathing, leaning towards or away from something, don't try to stop it. Don't try to stop it from leaning. As we've seen, trying to make a leaning mind stop leaning is just another form of leaning. Just be aware when your mind is leaning and realize what leaning mind actually is. Just realize what leaning mind actually is. With practice and attention to this moment, with practice and attention to this moment, your mind will of its own accord lean less. So just with attention, not with a sense of attaining something different or knowing, I use this term like gaining command of, I think is sort of what is being referred to as knowing. So unattainable, unknowable in the sense of there's no need to gain command or gain knowledge of something else. Steve is simplifying it to just paying attention to this moment. With practice and attention to this moment, your mind will, of its own accord, lean less. That phrase, realize what leaning of mind actually is. And I go back to the phrase that the great sky does not obstruct or bother the function of the white cloud. Realizing what leaning of mind is, again, is just allowing the clouds to drift through. I think in some sense, it's a matter of two different things. With inattention, it's just very normal for us to get strung along with a type of reactivity. So with inattention, there is this inside and outside, the usual way of seeing things, the things that we want, like, dislike, so forth. That's inattention to what is happening in the immediacy of this experience. Again, reactivity just kind of naturally happens, or it's a normal thing. But on the other side of that, there is the possibility of actually just being okay with thinking. To let the clouds freely pass. And again, I bring in unpleasant or pleasant. So no matter what the thinking is, whatever the inclination is, however we may define it, if it's neutral, we probably don't end up, we sort of let things drift by if they're neutral anyway. So it's more pleasant and unpleasant. So whatever it is, we may focus on the unpleasant things more, but again, it's even something pleasant. There's a tendency to want to keep that or to perpetuate it somehow. And this is to basically defy what is actually happening. We can not scold ourselves in any way. If it's something, you know, taking a bite of ice cream or something like that, it's not about, you know, trying to get rid of that experience or anything along those lines, just letting it pass through. But it's pretty quick. I was thinking of the example of maybe we'll be walking through the woods after a rain, and we kind of duck underneath a tree and sort of brush a branch that's above us, and all this cold water goes down the back of our neck, and it's just like instant lightning fast, or just cringe or whatever. You know, so the reaction happens so quickly, but really it's, you know, to be okay with that. Again, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, just to let that drift by, just to let that happen, including the reaction without judgment. So maybe we'll think, oh, I shouldn't have reacted so quickly. You know, maybe I should have let things drift by with a mind of equanimity. But really, the reactivity too, that's just kind of like another form that is appearing. The appearance of the feeling of the cool water, or just this apparent feeling of reactivity. It's all fine. We can just be here with that and let reality play as it is. And the same thing with wanting to attain or know or gain command of something. We can, if that impulse comes up, just let that be as it is. as the clouds form and dissipate, this too, tendency to want to attain something, or if we're sitting and thinking, and I should say thinking just shows up in so many different ways. You know, we'll want to change something, or, you know, I could be doing something better. Let's see, like knee pain, wrote down a few things, or I'm feeling calm or sleepy, or, oh, I was lost in thought again. All these things are, if I could just attain something different. I think a lot of the time we're in sort of like a wordless state of kind of almost yearning or something, where what's happening now is just not quite what we're looking for, but we're not identifying anything. I think to even say that we're seeking enlightenment, that may be not too common, because that's pretty grandiose and pretty vague too, to kind of think about, you know, because we don't really know what that is, you know. And so these different arising appearances, forms of thinking or inclination, basically anything that's happening, whatever we think our life is, that's sort of just the cloud that's happening or that's drifting at that moment. Again, including wanting to attain our no. But just as Steve recommends here, with practice and attention to this moment, the mind will of its own accord, or can lean less just through attention itself. Steve also says at the end of the chapter here, a couple different parts, he says, as a leaf lands in the yard, so your mind will straighten up, so your mind will straighten up in a most natural way, in accord with mind itself, that is the whole. I'll read that again. As a leaf lands in the yard, which is just of this natural motion, non-intention, unwilled. As the leaf lands in the yard, so your mind will straighten up in a most natural way, and accord with the mind itself, that is the whole. Steve says our actions can come only, or it's possible that our actions can come out of a desire to be awake. And again, this is just that simple activity of attention in this moment. The desire to be awake. Yeah, Gary has a similar phrase here. He says, when each step of your life is stable, very naturally, even before you're conscious of it, the source of existence will penetrate you like wetness that soaks your dress when you walk in the mist. So attention to this moment, pleasant or pleasant, whatever's coming up, no need to interject. The sky cannot be hindered or accentuated or diminished by anything that we would do with any type of willed intent. This source of existence is the source of existence, which for me is kind of helpful. There's an encouraging side of that, that we don't have to turn the screws or really dig in there and transform something or use all our muscle power to try to get something to shift balance in another direction. It's just very simple with each step of our life, you know, taking each step in this moment and letting the stability come up very natural in that activity. in some sense, Buddhism, I mean, normally we think of what's desirable and undesirable as being very different things. But in Buddhism, I think there's not really too much reason to really kind of parse those things out in any different way. With the feeling of there's desirable and undesirable, you know, right there, the gap is manifest, basically. As Katagiri was saying, if we think we are connected with something or disconnected, we'll feel a gap. So desirable or undesirable, including the judgments we may have of ourselves or of our practice or anything, that really, none of that is, we can just set all that down, basically. It's not helpful to focus on those things or try to discriminate good and bad, desirable and undesirable. And realize what is truly unknowable, unattainable in respect to this moment already being fully what it is, always right here, that there's nothing to gain, there's nothing to gain command of or attain. So noticing a thought or anything at all, whatever's happening can arise. It could be a thought or the sound of a bird or anything. Anything could be happening in this moment. And to approach this with an open hand, I think, is what these teachers are recommending for us, this very gentle approach. When we were out camping, it was raining quite a bit, 2 days pretty much full, well, pretty good amount of rain, basically. But it was super quiet. Normally you get a little bit of wind when you have rain, but it was just, the rain was just coming straight down. There's no wind at all. It was kind of funny because we had mentioned that we didn't hear a beaver or see a beaver at all during the whole trip. Only once at night we heard the tail flap down. And but then we got introduced to the beaver like straight on as we exited the boundary waters. But there's one experience. I was just sitting next to the shore and it was just ultra quiet with tiny little raindrops coming down and making tiny little tapping sounds on the water. So it was an interesting experience. Part of the boundary waters, I think, is that you're in there, you know, we're 5 hours in paddling, so you're there. It's a little bit like Sesshin, that where you can be in nature and you're maybe not doing what you want. You don't want to be out in the rain, but you're there. So you're putting yourself kind of in the situation of what the rest of the environment is kind of marinating in all the time. So there's a freedom in that. And just hearing those little tiny droplets of rain on the water was, you know, just very simple experience. I didn't have to do anything just besides be there and sit there in the rain. You know, normally maybe we wouldn't want to be in the rain, but it was, had an exquisite quality to it. That's pretty much all I have in terms of my talk today. So I don't know if anybody has any questions or comments at all. We got 5 or so minutes. Yeah, Peter.
We use words.
Oh, I think we're going to get you the microphone. so folks on Zoom could hear.
Where do I talk?
Yeah, just hold it by your sign right there.
Okay. Thanks, Bo.
So we used a lot of words that are misleading, and most of them. But you were talking about beginnings and ends, not in the usual way. Usually we understand beginning and end on a small scale that we're familiar with personally, you know, like you have a dog and the dog is born and then it dies. And it seems so clear, but then we take that as a model and project it on the universe, and we think that reality has a beginning and an end, and that's preposterous. And dependent arising also, you know it because there's infinite change all the time. There's a flow, but if it's infinite change and a flow, you can't say that if there's a start and an end, because it's still reality and it doesn't change, but the details change. They manifestations change. But anyway, what do you think about the idea of beginnings and ends as applied to the universe or to reality and or dependent arising? I think it's absurd, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much absurd too, and fascinating to see the incarnations of beginnings and ends, or even the Big Bang. You know, there could be a relative truth about that where it shows up kind of as a beginning. So out of this beginningless, endless reality, the image or the a way of saying a beginning is the Big Bang is possible, and we can use it and it, you know, sort of build on our understanding. So there's like what conceptual thinking brings to the table, kind of the achievements of men and women through the past, scientific achievements. I think a lot of those aren't possible if you really had a really strong grasp or like a real strong inclination of this is an absolute beginning or an absolute end. The greatest scientists know that this is always provisional. It could be disproven, and there's always something deeper or some other flip side. There's a quantum side to it or anything. So ironically, the beginningless, endless truth of what's happening gives us the ability to sort of play with these ideas of beginnings and ends, get understandings, maybe understandings that can help us help each other. I was thinking of endless practice too. That's sometimes that comes up, which may sound kind of like debilitating or something, almost like this practice never ends. We kind of want an end point that we can think of, okay, finally I'm done. But really, I think the really true sense of freedom actually comes out of a sense of no end. Because what is the alternative? That would be like a frozen reality. Nothing ever changes. Like, okay, we're enlightened. And then how horrible is it to think of just like static anything? So this reality is continual undulation and beauty. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways of looking at it. I guess I don't know I elaborated on your question there. I don't know if I answered it or not, but thanks, Peter. Yeah, do we, you got a time for one quick question on Zoom if we got it? Okay.
Okay. All right. Yes. My question concerns intention. I mean, given the example of the beaver, could it not be said that the beaver had the intention to cut down the birch tree? And how could you construct a city like Minneapolis, for example, without intention? I don't see how that's possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if we take a close look at Steve Hagen's writing there, he's not insinuating that you get rid of intention or try to transform it, but to see it clearly. And to your point on the beaver, I do agree. It's all these examples are limited, so it's probably good not to make like a direct correlation to the teachings themselves. The beaver for me is an image of basically this animal being very much the environment itself, and like personal, I don't know. I don't want to get too much into attention right there. But basically, that's what I'm thinking in terms of the image of the beaver. It helps us move forward a little bit out of our normal human way of seeing things, which is very dichotomy oriented. Animals are in a seem, you know, they seem to exhibit something that is much more broad, much more in balance, basically. So that's why I use it, but okay, those are good points. Yeah.
Okay.
And then building a city, you know, of course, yeah, we need to use practical thinking. I don't know if intention is totally necessary though for even practical things. If we can truly see how intention gets us entangled in all kinds of problems. Dogen has some writings about this as well, where even building a temple, he kind of explains it as not having, I don't know, it's a very subtle teaching, but not really focusing on some sort of end goal like we normally do. And I guess I can't really explain what that would look like. An intentionless world, but it would look a lot different than what we normally see, I think. So okay. Thanks, Michael. We're a little bit over, so okay. Yeah. Sorry for taking up so much time. You can okay. Thanks. And thanks, Michael. It's good to see everybody. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.